Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and we are doing our series of interviews with our faculty members for the system seminar. Today's guest will be a special speaker at the system club meeting, but he will be attending the seminar, and you might have a chance to chat with him and learn from him, but right now you can learn from him on the call. Great story about how I met our guest today. I'm in New Orleans, and I was driving around with my programmer, Steve Goyette, who came down for a few days for work and some, you know, some rest and relaxation as well. And we were listening to the local music station, and they were interviewing this guy with a British accent. And we were sort of, okay, what's going on here? And he started talking about promoting bands and managing tours and all the things that are important to the career of musicians. And many of you know, I used to be in the music business myself. I managed a record label, and I promoted concerts, and I had one artist that I managed, and I really got the sense firsthand of what a rigorous, serious, challenging, no-nonsense business that is, so much so that I left it and did easy stuff. But I always remembered and always had great regard and understood the lessons that I got from that experience, and I've tried to convey that to people over the years. You know, I try to explain, look, guys, when you put on a, you know, branding is nice, but when you put on a concert and there's nobody out there, you have not won. You can't pretend that you've won, and that's one of the great lessons of direct marketing. It's one of the great lessons of internet marketing, that, you know, we can count our results, and it's one of the great lessons that you can get from producing live events. So we were so transfixed by the things that this guy was saying, that when we got to where we were going, we sat in the car for another 20 minutes and listened to the rest of the interview so we could figure out where he was going to be speaking. And he was speaking at a college, and we made sure that we went and heard the whole talk. The talk was even more amazing than the speech or the radio appearance, and I bought his book, and I asked if he'd consider talking to system club grads at the system club meeting. He said, yes, I'm thrilled, because he's going to really bring some very powerful, if nothing more, attitudinal thing to the table. There's just a sort of urgency and need to hustle that being in a competitive environment like music instills in you. And I try to convey it, and he's going to do a fantastic job of conveying it. So it was a long-winded introduction, but I want to introduce everybody to Martin Atkins. Martin.
Hi, Ken. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and thanks for being on the call. Now, you've got a really interesting history that I'd like to share with people, pretty unique. You're originally from Leeds, England.
Well, I was born very close to Coventry, England, a place called Nuneaton.
Okay.
But by the time I was 9 months old, we'd relocated to Leeds. My father was involved with the textile industry,
gotcha,
which is
huge.
Used to exist in Europe somewhere.
Yep, Leeds and Manchester and maybe even Liverpool. I don't know if they had textiles as well.
Yeah.
Interesting history. That's, you know, when I'm in New Orleans right now, and there was a huge connection between New Orleans and that part of the world, because that's where all the cotton went from out of the port of New Orleans to the western ports in England. And then
right. That's
the mills there. And then on to India, the great empire, you know?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So you somehow got caught up in music.
Well, that was one of those things, you know, my dad used to play trombone in like a Dixieland band. And I think very early on had to make the decision between night school and supporting his young growing family and playing the trombone. And it was a no-brainer back then.
Mm-hmm.
He gave up the trombone and the banjo and went to school and worked his way up to become a managing director and then a consultant for Courtauld, a textile firm. And I think when I was 9 years old, he bought me a drum kit. And I don't remember wanting to be a drummer or expressing to anybody that I wanted to be a drummer, but he bought me a drum kit, and so I played for 4 hours a day until my arms fell off.
Wow.
If he'd bought me a lawnmower, I'd be talking to you about my landscaping business right now. So I started playing when I was 9 and listening to Beatles albums and teaching myself how to play. And then I started to look for bands to play with when I was 11 or 12 and ended up doing the music for being in the backing band for some strippers at a club in Newcastle at a very young age. And then worked my way down to London. By the time I was 17, I think I was old and jaded musically and ready to join a band with Johnny Rotten, who had just imploded the Sex Pistols, a band that I'm sure many of you people listening to this are familiar with.
And this was the very roots of punk rock.
Well, the Sex Pistols were. I think Public Image Limited, PIL, the band he formed after the Sex Pistols, was definitely second generation, using the notoriety he'd gained to allow himself and the band to explore dub or reggae and experiment in the studio and with graphic design and with music and the presentation of all of it. So I spent 5 years with that band and toured the world, Japan, Australia, Europe, and America. And at some point early in there, I think 1981, I moved to the States, relocated to the States. And then after that, I played with a bunch of semi-notorious bands from Europe's Killing Joke to a band called Ministry and Nine Inch Nails, who I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Started my own record label along the way and just forged a... I'm sorry?
That's the part I'm interested in is... You know, we've all met musicians that all they do is they play, and then they're done, and they don't really get involved in the business side of things, and sometimes, often to their detriment, and they miss out on a lot of opportunities. But somehow you saw very early on that the business side was as important as the performing side.
Well, but not for traditional business reasons. When I hit my bass drum, I like to have very good quality or loud monitors on stage because I like to hear my bass drum, played back to me through 2 18-inch speakers, so literally, blow drying my hair with the air that's being moved. And so when that was... when that was removed, let's say by a promoter who said, well, we haven't sold enough tickets, that's why you only have this tiny little monitor and your bass drum sounds crap, and that's why we don't have 4 18-inch speakers on either side of the PA system, so nobody in the audience is getting the same feeling for the bass drum either. I'd sit behind my drum kit and halfway through a song, I'd start counting everybody that had paid to come in while I was playing, and sometimes I would just put my sticks down and march into the office and tell the promoter, go and get some speakers, and we'll go back on stage when you've plugged them in and lived up to your side of the bargain. So it wasn't necessarily that I was interested in money. It was because when business... Or people who seemed like they knew the business used that to reduce their expenses and then reduce my fun. Then I would get involved. And, for whatever reason I got involved, then I'm involved and I'm looking at ticket counts, ticket price, gross potential, record sales in the market, the power of choosing a different opening band to add muscle to the package, relationships and all of those things.
And then where this has evolved to, I get it. Your initial interest was in making sure you were able to do what you loved the way you wanted to do it, and that all, that always involves ultimately figuring out the financial ends of things.
Right.
But where that's involved now, though, is you have a recording studio and I believe a video studio as well in Chicago. You produce bands. Do you do any management as well?
I think not officially, but I think a good record label, a good record producer. I think the world is full of people now who are prepared to blur the lines and not say, well, that's not my job,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just uncovered something the other day, and I filmed it. We found some posters from 1991. I still have a band called Pigface. And these posters, there's only 10 left, but they were in a package that had been sent to us from Texas. And I recognized the return address. It was our agent.
Hmm.
And the reason I stopped to film it, the box and the packaging, was he was an agent who simply got tired of having record labels, bands, managers, forgetting to send out posters. And that one simple fact really started to eat into how well attended, how well promoted the shows he was booking as an agent were doing. So he just said, look, when he signed my band, I'm doing the posters. And I'm like, well, no, there's no discussion. I'm doing the posters. I'll send you some of them, but I'm going to have them in my office. So I'll just send them out when I send out the contract.
Mm.
And it's that attitude that, for the time being, let's call it that's not my job attitude that made him a more successful agent. And I think there's lessons in all of this stuff that are much broader. When you see something that's affecting your bottom line and other people who, you know, your business isn't their priority. So you can either spend your life running around, double-checking, reminding people, and hoping that they've done what they said they're going to do, or, you know, when the consequences are high, and, I mean, it's 2008, I don't know of any situations where there aren't horrible consequences for balls being dropped, you know, how much effort is it to actually do the posters and send them out? It's probably less effort to do that than it is to keep calling the manager or the record label or the band. Did you send the posters here? Did you send the posters there? And it's kind of liberating. You can get on with something else.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I was just having a conversation last night with a colleague who runs his business a lot like I run mine, which is that we're very lean. I have one full-time office manager, assistant, some contract people that help with various things, but we like to have our hands on everything because we know how important every little piece is. And you're right, dropping even a simple ball at a critical time can mean a really reduced result. One of the things that you've done in addition to the record label and record producing and the studio. Is you've become an educator for the music industry, and that's I have your book, which is fantastic. I don't remember the title of it, but I keep it around the office here. What is it called? And we'll talk a little bit about what's in it in a second.
Well, thanks, Ken. It's called Tour Smart.
Great.
And anybody that's interested, I think you can go to Amazon and. You can do a thing where look inside the book, and there's some great reviews up there, and there's some pretty broad content, I think.
Oh, absolutely, and people may say, well, I'm not a rock and roll musician, and I'm not touring, and I, what does this have to do with me? But there are several things I absolutely adore about the book. Number one is the promotional smarts. That just is, the whole book is infused with it, and let's face it, there's probably no more competitive arena in the world than the music business. Why? Because Well, anybody can go to the store right now and get a set of drums and get a guitar, and it's quite pleasant to play music, and there's lots and lots and lots and lots of people that play music, some of them quite well. And, you know, it's one of those fields where the supply is infinite. And, you know, every market has a limited demand. There's, you know, you reach a saturation point at a certain point. So it's not just the United States. It's every country is producing musicians, and new ones come along all the time, and then the great musicians hang in there, and it's really, from a competitive point of view, frightening. And what Martin has done successfully, continues to do, and is now teaching others to do, is take bands from obscurity and finding a way to insert them into the public's consciousness, where that awareness turns into, you know, sold-out concert performances and lots of albums sold, and lots of notoriety, and bottom line, a business that makes money and is sustaining and sustainable. That's one part of the book that I found just fascinating, regardless of whatever you market. And then the second thing I loved about it was you write better than almost anybody I can think of. In fact, right now I can't think of anybody that does it better, about the realities of how business really works. Now, you're talking in terms of the touring business in the book primarily, but the reality of business is it's very messy. All kinds of absolutely crazy, off-the-wall, insane things seem to happen all the time.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't hear this at Harvard Business School, and you certainly don't read about it in some of the more cookbook type how-to business books. You always hear the ideal scenario, and you know, here are the perfect things that you do, and if you just do them, everything will come along beautifully. And you do lay down a lot of principles and give a lot of very concrete suggestions that are, you know, specific for people in the music industry. But what I also like is you just tell the stories about all the crazy stuff that happens, which I think is very important, because that's what really happens when you attempt a venture, whether it's a music tour or opening a new restaurant or whatever it may be. The reality is crazy stuff happens. One story that really sticks out, and I'm sure you'll remember it, is you point out, and I've already been able to help some people with this idea, that when you do a live performance, bringing and selling merchandise, T-shirts, bumper stickers, whatever, at the event is really important. Not only for the small amount of revenue that gets generated, but just as a way to get people to stick and remember you and tell their friends, potentially come back. And it's a essential part of any touring enterprise. But then you talked about a company that, was very unsuccessful in hiring efficient merchandise managers. You were talking about, remember the one girl that went on the road and she couldn't quite count the money, and she shipped the money off to the wrong place. And
right, and then that's coupled with a manager who decided, you know, that's the... I don't think this is confined to the music business, but somebody who had some idea that they'd always wanted to do, so, you know, these ideas come to the surface whenever they can, and this manager decided that the band should have their own teacups. Or coffee mugs. He was British, that's why I said teacups.
Okay.
And, you know, interesting idea. You know, if the band had had a song called I Like to Drink Coffee or anything, you know, anything. But they didn't, and most of the cups were smashed. I think they managed to retrieve 1 in 10. And while he was concerned about that and the design of the coffee cup, they were failing with the shirts that they should have been selling to these crazy girls running after one of these teen bands. I think that the role of merchandise, it has to do with changing this transient feeling, and I describe it like incense, smoke, a nice smell that dissipates very, very quickly. You're just trying to turn that day's worth of nice smell into something that's going to have a longer shelf life. And that will sustain until you can get back to wherever that market is and start ringing the bell again, you know. And a lot of bands have difficulty with this whole idea of art and business. But I don't think there's a line anymore. Art is business and business is art. It's all intertwined.
And you've done some innovative things, for instance, within your music business, which is involving fine art as part of your product mix. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. I've always been interested. You know, I was at my mom and dad's last week, and here's this horrible poster that I drew when I was 11. You know, so obviously I've always been interested in that, but. Most recently, I did a simple overprint onto a blank color religious poster, and it had many meanings. It's kind of a punk rock idea, but now we've introduced the idea of limited hand screened, signed, and numbered posters. So they get stolen from venues because they have a value. They can be resold on eBay, which causes a ripple of activity. You know, people at the venue thought, oh my goodness, the posters have been stolen. It implies that everything about these bands or the touring entity that we're creating is in demand. And then phone calls start between the venue and my office. And that's always a good thing, to have more communication. And so not only are we fueling the show beforehand, but we're creating a revenue stream for afterwards, where people who were at the concert but didn't have any money or whatever can buy posters online. And after doing this for 20 years, I've had gallery shows here in Chicago and in Manhattan. And soon other places around the world. So by always going the extra mile, you create other opportunities for yourself that perhaps you don't see at the time that you're going the extra mile.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you have an option anymore of not going the extra mile and putting your feet up and hoping that everything's going to be okay. I mean,
This is a theme that you bring up over and over again, and it's so important, because you and I remember this from my brief concert promoting days. It's like you don't know exactly what you have an idea. You know what you need to do in general, and all the bases you have to cover, and you know they must be covered, but you don't know exactly what the most important or the less important is, or you never know so in other words, you have to do everything. I guess I'm finding myself at a lack of words, but you just have to do everything you can to get people to come, whatever it might be, and you just do it, and you try this and you try that, and you just don't stop. And the reason I'm so happy you're coming to Chicago is we have a lot of people who are relatively new to business. And they've received what amounts to a theoretical education about how to promote and how to market. And sometimes they can get quite sophisticated. They know a lot about search engine marketing, and they know quite a bit about pay-per-click, and they learn about enhancing conversion and all these things. But I note the pace at which they work, and I note the intensity at which they work. And I'm not surprised sometimes when their results are less than spectacular. Because I think you can confirm this, when it comes to ramping something up out of nothing, the amount of energy required, whether it's a rock and roll band or an online store, is huge.
Right. It's 28 hours a day, 9 days a week. And, I think this, I began educating in the music business 5 years ago, over the last 5 years, I think I've been frustrated and frightened, talking to students around the world. You know, I was just in Cologne, Germany, Oslo, Norway, London, Brighton, Coventry, all over the place, lecturing to people who are trying to come into this business. And I just try and tell them that they have to think on their feet. I try and give them bits of advice that are going to help no matter what happens. You know, and so I'll say, you know, if you can't do anything else other than get 3 jobs, work 7 days a week and just sleep for 2 hours a night, just do that. At least it's good training. You know, at least if you can't find a job in a studio or a record label, there are things that you can do to gain some important skills. And things move very, very quickly. And but the good thing is, if people are paying attention to their own business, they'll see things. When you just have somebody doing things for you, maybe they'll say, well, yeah, I sent out those emails. Like, yeah, that's great, but do I have an early check-in to my hotel in Oslo? Because if I don't, I'm sitting in the lobby for 5 hours drinking coffee, and then by the time I get up to my room, I'm going to be so wired I'm not going to sleep. So I'm not interested in how many emails you've sent or whether you sent flowers to the people at the reception. I want an early check-in. You know? And when it's you, when it's your ass sitting in the lobby drinking coffee or whatever, you pay attention to that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just start to know things. And that's another important part of this. I tell this to bands, and it's true for anybody. When you're doing your thing, you know, different headlines leap off of newspapers. Different things leap out of the internet at you because they have to do with the central thing that you're focused on, or the stuff in the periphery. And you become an expert on your thing. And, you know, you can get into problems when you start second-guessing yourself or listening to other people or going back to the business basics that you began with, because all of that stuff is out of the window once you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to trust the feelings that you have, because that's your instrument is tuned, you know. And I've kind of trained myself now. When I'm in the studio, you know, and I sit down and listen to a song that I've been working on, and maybe I haven't listened to something for a couple of days, and you sit down and you'll go, oh, that vocal's out of tune, or something is weird with the drums, something will just hit you.
Mm-hmm.
But I just write that down immediately because it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens the next time you listen through, your brain has told another part of your brain, you know, if those drums are weird, that's another fucking day's worth of work. You know, all this other stuff kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, your brain's convinced you that the drums are okay.
Mm.
And the fact is they're not. And so, and I have that all the time. When I get an impression and a feeling, I've learned to trust it, because there are, you know, it's tough when you're working on your own. Maybe you don't have a sounding board, and it's tough. You can, you know, you start listening to a couple of people, and next thing you know, you've just lost the plot completely, and you have to learn to listen to yourself.
I didn't realize we were gonna go on this topic, but I can't tell you how important this particular topic is for in our particular industry, this the internet marketing industry, because we have proliferation of experts and gurus and advice givers, and some of them are quite compelling, and more than once, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this call have been there. More than once, somebody who's had a sound business that they built up through their own good instincts has followed the advice, given over their guidance system to a so-called expert, and found their business running into the rocks. In fact, I had a call with a man. This is interesting. You know, just the other day, brilliant internet person, has been involved at a high level in the industry since the very beginning. He wanted to try something new and package some of the things that he'd learned to a new market. He felt a little insecure about entering that market, so he went to the experts, and he threw out everything that he knew and understood and had learned over the last 15-plus years, and nothing worked. And he realized after burning 6 months and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that he had known all along the right way to market his new venture. It was a method that he'd been using successfully and proven based on millions and millions of dollars of online sales that he generated. This is such a great lesson. Not first to be fully engaged. This is what you drove home so strongly with the college students. And it's not just a college student problem. I think until you are fully engaged, you don't really know what it means to be fully engaged. And the gap between sort of hacking around and being fully engaged is the difference, in my opinion, between life and death in business.
It's like I tell students, you know, watch Dangerous Catch on the Discovery Channel, and they're like, well, yeah, hold on a minute, this is a show about crab fishermen. Mm-hmm. And I want to be in the music business. And so then I can make a joke about, well, you know, if you're on a crab boat in Alaska, you're working with a bunch of lunatics, possibly criminals, and either on that boat or in the music business, you're never far away from the thing that you're searching for. But they had a guy, and he nearly severed his own thumb. You know, and if that happened in my office, you know, well, unless it was tour time or we had a new record coming out, we'd stop, we'd take somebody to the emergency room, and, you know, we'd buy flowers and a card and probably a bottle of whiskey, and we'd freak out for a couple of days. But on this crab boat, this guy just wrapped some electrical insulating tape around his hand and went back out for another 14 hours. And that's what it's like when you're doing your own thing. You know, there's either crab in the crab pots or there aren't. And if there aren't, you keep searching. And when there are, you bring those crabs in and you turn them into money. You don't go, hey, well, that's it. It's 5 o'clock. See ya. You know.
Right.
And so that's like, you know, in entertainment, when you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not. And I'm sure that's true with any brand. Anything that you're trying to market. And I think the good thing about taking responsibility yourself is that when other people have done things for me and just failed, you know, all you can do is kind of like, yeah, you know, I would have done it differently, and now I don't like the way I'm sounding, and blah, blah, blah. But when you do it yourself, you could see the initial results, and you know at the end of day one, this isn't enough from the end of day one. There's no excitement. This isn't going to build. What can I do to address this now before it's over?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the worst things I encountered was people being nice. I mean, it's the most dangerous thing. When we plan a 50-day tour, we play every day. We have to because the expenses are so high. And something I learned from a documentary called The War Room and episodes of The West Wing, you know, you see how you're doing in certain markets and you apply your limited resources to the markets where those resources can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So on an episode of The West Wing, they'll say, listen, you know, we're never going to win in Massachusetts. Don't spend any more money there. We're not going there. But if we spend that money in these two markets, we stand a chance of winning. And we do the same with when we do a package tour with 4 or 5 bands. But what I need from a venue in Phoenix, Arizona, or Tampa, Florida, or Chicago, I need an accurate ticket count 6 weeks before the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I can use that information.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd call around to these venues, and the promoters would say, hey, Martin, it's great to speak to you. Oh, the show's going to be great. Can't wait to see you. I'm like, yeah. Well, how many tickets have you sold? Oh, we can't, you know, I remember, you know, they'd say anything. We'd have a nice conversation. But I wouldn't get the information that I needed. So in the end, I'd have somebody else from my office call. And a venue that had been nice to me the day before, the promoter would say, oh, my goodness, we haven't sold many tickets. We're really worried. Well, that's fantastic. That's the friendly information that I wanted, because I can do something with that information. I can't do anything with someone's hopes and respect and best wishes. You know, but hard information, I can do something with. I can go, okay, Tuesday night in Phoenix, we've only sold 50 tickets. Well, it's a small place. We don't care. We're fine. You know, we'll put some people on the guest list. It will look crowded. But if it's a 1,000-capacity venue in Phoenix, well, I've got to do something. And,
right, and this is so important that, you, and I've experienced it viscerally, you've experienced it viscerally. I wish everybody on this call could experience it viscerally. When you're putting on a show, and show in quotes, it could be a product launch, it could be anything, but it's so vivid in the music industry. When you're putting on a show and nobody's in the audience, I mean, that is just the worst possible outcome, and you don't let it happen twice.
Right, and I mean, and there's nothing you can do. And then the most amazing accidental collisions will occur. It's great when they occur in a good way. Like, oh my goodness, this guy's in the audience and he promotes 5 casinos and we've been offered a residency for $5,000 a night and, you know, and his daughter's really hot, you know. But Murphy's Law operates in the reverse of that. And if there are only 2 people at your product launch or your show in a 1,000-capacity venue or whatever circumstance, one of those people will be the music critic for the New York Times or, you know, Inc. magazine or Entrepreneur magazine, you know, thumbs down to your new product. The other person will be somebody equally important or a hot guy or a girl that you're looking to spend some time with later on, and now you're not because you just stood on a stage and failed. And that's the way it is. And sometimes it's not necessarily about how can we create the most successful event ever. You know, sometimes it's equally as important or more important just to think, how can we make sure this isn't a catastrophe?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Charlie Watts, the drummer from the Rolling Stones, was asked which drummers he really liked to watch. And for me, you know, I would answer Billy Cobham, Buddy Rich, Danny Carey, the drummer from Tool, all amazing drummers. But Charlie Watts said, I like to watch the worst drummers. And the interviewer said, well, why? And he said, I just find it easier to see what not to do than to try and watch an amazingly talented person and try and understand what to do. It's just easier for him to look at what not to do. And I think that's a really important gem. Not that I want to start a club of drummers with good information. But
absolutely, and this again, this applies directly to my industry. We have a lot of superstars in our industry, golden boys who are just, you know, they can do no wrong and everything they touch turns to gold. And some of them actually are quite bright. And what I find is people look to these folks and their performances, and they are performances to a large degree, and become intimidated and frozen because they look at where they are at and they look where these guys are at and they can't imagine closing the gap, and they it doesn't help them. It doesn't help them to be exposed to the stars of Internet marketing. It helps them to be exposed to the serious practitioners of Internet marketing who are willing to, you know, come down to earth and drill down and focus on a particular aspect of Internet marketing.
Right.
So
it's mesmerizing to look. I love this analogy. You know, I was at the Great Wall of China in 2006. And, you know, I think I'm a fairly spiritual, you know, enlightened person sometimes. And you look at the Great Wall of China, and what can you do except go, oh, my God, it's unbelievable. It's amazing. How on earth did they do it? Well, but the answer is, Well, how did they do it? Well, they put it's a really big pile of bricks. You know, and there are the mystics and the spiritual people who are, it's one of the seven wonders of the world and blah, blah, it's a miracle. It's not a miracle. It's a really big pile of bricks.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you can wander around with your head in your hands. How on earth can we do the Great Wall of China? We'll never do it. How do we do it? What's the secret? You know, well, press button A, $5,000, I'll give you the secret. Well, no, I won't, but, you know, I'll do, you know, there's lots of people who will give you the secret of the instant Great Wall of China, which doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, if you just start putting the piles of bricks together, at the end of day one, you'll still be absolutely nowhere near making the Great Wall of China, but you'll be further along than nowhere.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know, you put your head down, you start stacking the bricks, and you get blisters and calluses, and then, you know, you burst some blisters, and your hands are bleeding, and then your hands get toughened up, and, you know, all of those muscles from carrying that, you find you carry two more bricks, and weird muscles start to hurt, but then you overcome that, and you just put your head down. At the end of a year, I don't know, maybe you've got a mile. You know, it's just a pile of bricks. And looking up at U2 or the Rolling Stones, you know, doesn't do anybody any good. It's just, you know, they don't even remember how hard it was. They probably fired everybody that was with them when they were stacking the bricks because they're kind of embarrassed and bummed to be reminded of when their hands were bleeding and they didn't eat and it was just tough and they sat on the side of the hill and just cried, you know. So most often the people on the team will get fired. So then the Rolling Stones and U2 are free to just fantasize about how the 12-year journey was, in fact, an overnight sensation, and waffle on about, you know, other things other than the crazy amount of hours and hard work that it was.
Oh, what a great lesson. That is invaluable for our industry. I can't tell you how relevant it is. Now, you've already given us far more time than you promised, and I appreciate that. I wonder if I could squeeze a little more time out of you. If not, I understand, but there's...
No, it's fine. I like talking to you, Ken.
Oh, I appreciate it. There was a saying that you said during the talk in New Orleans, and this is a G or GP rated show, so I'm going to ask you to figure out a different word. But I'll say the saying, and I'd like you to talk about it. When you know you are in the bad situation,
screwed? Can we say that?
We can say that. When you know you're screwed, you have a chance. I'm messing it up. Could you say
right. If you can know and understand totally that you're screwed
mm-hmm.
by everything, by the world, by 2008, by whatever, you know, by the dollar, what a mess that is. If you can know and understand that you're totally, completely screwed, then you're not. If you think that you're not, then you absolutely are.
Mm. I love
and,
this. And, this you know,
and you know what? I hope you'll let me do this at the conference. When I was in Cologne, I had all these German students at the music conservatory there, and I'm like, okay, I'll give a free book to the German student who will translate that into German for me. and it's fantastic. In German, it's just fantastic. So you have this very strange situation of maybe 50 people in a class, and I went straight to England with it, and I typed it into my PowerPoint, you know. So you have this strange situation of 50 kids who are looking to enter the music business crying with laughter at the reality that they are completely screwed. And I love that because they'll remember that. And
yeah,
maybe just spend that extra couple of hours double-checking something, doing the things that they know they need to do to make sure that the things that need to happen happen. And that's all it is.
Mm. I love that. I love that. You know, I'm thinking out loud right now, maybe in Chicago I might say to my System Club members, I want everybody here to pretend that you've got a rock and roll band, and that you are now playing in your garage, and you know the only people who listen to you are your dog, and your 5-year-old nephew who can only listen for 2 minutes before he wanders away. How would you go from that to playing in the Felt Forum at Madison Square Garden? And of course, they're all going to be completely baffled as to how they would do that. And then maybe I would have you just lay out the program that you lay out in your book and also lay out in your talks, and have them extrapolate that and talk to them as if they were rock and roll musicians, as if they were musicians. And then, because I think the lessons are just so immediately obviously transferable, and I have to say, anybody that can't transfer the lessons is probably so thick that nothing will help them. But this,
right? And you one of the things I tell students is that whatever your skill set is, you have to acquire a new skill, which is the skill of acquiring skills,
mm-hmm.
and they don't like to hear that, but that's the reality of it. And I hate the term thinking outside the box, but it's actually a pretty good term. And I think one of the problems for a lot of people is sort of finding the box. Where's the bloody box? I can think outside of it if you show me where it is. The box keeps moving. And I think that I'm interested. I'd be very interested to play the reverse of that game as well, which is, okay, Mr. Atkins, I've got a new aluminum smelting factory, and we're producing these tins to cook turkey in, and blah blah blah, or suggestions for making more shower curtains sell. We could have a game.
Absolutely,
I love stuff like that.
Great, and it really is. It is a different product, different market, different time, but the same game.
Right. It's not pop music. Right now, it's basic marketing. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, they're just pop stars.
Absolutely.
That's all they are. And the news is theater. Everything's a sell. Everything's a hit single. It's all a sell.
And we're trying to make, if we're an expert and positioning ourselves as experts, we're trying to make ourselves into a pop star. Or if we have a product, we're trying to make the product into a pop star. So yeah, there's no wall here. Another very simple thing you said to the students, which it's just so important, and it's just not said enough. Well, let's say you're a band and you're not famous yet, you're not even close, but you get an opportunity to play to 15 people, and it doesn't doesn't mean traveling across the continent and making no money. You might break even. You might break even and sell a T-shirt, but everything, it's you're not going to lose. Do you stay home and watch TV and say, well, it's not worthy, you're not worth my time to go and play for 15 people, or do you get in the car, load up the gear, and go and play? What's your assessment on that?
I have a few sayings that fit that. You aim low and ultimately get high. The way to become U2 is to play to 5 people. That's all U2 did. I saw them play to 17 people in London. And, interestingly enough, just to bring this full circle, when you heard me on the radio, I was in New Orleans. That was a tiny jazz station
mm-hmm.
above a toy store.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not a jazz guy. I've listened to jazz. Some of my ideas you could say are like jam bands. They have a jazz element to them. But I remember that morning going, I'm tired. What is this?
Sure.
How far is this jazz radio station? Do I really need to do it? Or could I sleep for another hour?
Right.
And, you never know. You can't start to quantify one opportunity over another, because the big opportunity might turn out to be not the opportunity you thought, and the small opportunity might have way more of a lasting benefit. So you can trace directly, you know, from that day where I decided to do that small, seemingly not quite correct radio interview, we can trace that directly to a point where I'd be jumping up and down on stage swearing my head off at your event.
That's right, and it'll be in Chicago, which is your hometown, so you won't even have to get on a plane to do it.
Fantastic.
And you get to
attend. I'm excited to meet everybody and talk to people and have some ideas bounce around, because that's the fuel that keeps me going these days is inspiration and ideas and that really gets me going.
And this corollary, and you really told it in this story. Not only do you take the gig, obviously if you're the Rolling Stones and someone says, would you play at the local Chamber of Commerce dance, you're not going to do that. It doesn't make business sense. But when you're low, I love it. Aim low and get high. Very important. But intrinsic in that, and I want to state it, even though you did include it, is when you show up for that audience of five, you play as if you're playing to 50,000. You don't say, well, I'll give. And that's the thing about your interview too on the radio. I mean, it is a small radio station. It had a very narrow niche audience, but you didn't. What's the old saying? Phone it in. You gave it your all. What if you hadn't? What if you said, well, I'll show up, but I'll be sort of haphazard about it. You weren't. And I think that's where I see a lot of beginners in business shoot themselves in the foot. They start discriminating between what's important and what's not important, what they think is important and what's not important. And what's always important is that when you're ever in front of live people, it's your all, because you never know. I was told that the Ritz, it was the Hilton, what's that famous, I'm going to draw a blank. It's a very famous hotel in New York City. But the way it got founded was there was a guy running, he was managing a not very fancy at all hotel in an obscure city somewhere, and this man and his elderly mother came through town, and the mother was ill, and there were no rooms left in the hotel, and the clerk said, well, look, I have a room here, and so what I'm going to do is clean up my room and give it to you, because clearly you need a room, and I'll sleep in a broom closet or something, and that'll be fine. He didn't know who the people were. They were just nice. They were well-dressed, but he had no idea who they were. And they ended up being the people that wrote a massive check for him to start his the Waldorf Astoria.
All right.
That is where the original funding for what turned out to be the Waldorf Astoria came from, a simple, wholehearted, full-fledged effort to do the right thing when you show up on the job. So you never do know. I'd like to end the call with a simple little piece of advice that you gave that was awesome, and then probably talk just briefly about something I might have done better to talk about at the beginning of the call. But let's talk about this simple piece of advice: markets. Some people on this call may do tours. They may do tours to introduce a product, physical tours. They may do speaking tours. They may do book tours. They may do seminar tours. You came up with a very simple insight based on years and years and years of traveling around the United States as to how to lay out, how to pick which cities you'll focus on, if your resources are limited. You draw a line in the map. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I love that part of what I do, because I haven't seen anybody else do that. We're a few generations of ideas past that now, which we're holding back for another book. But you draw a line from Minneapolis to Texas. Mm-hmm. And my question was, how many of the top 100 markets, just by size, are west of that line? And that line pretty much divides the states into the 1,200 miles of the eastern side and the 1,800 to 2,000 miles west of that line. And there are only 16 or 17 markets west of that line. But west of that line, especially now with gasoline prices, west of that line are the 800-mile drives, the 900-mile drives, just the relentless mileage that chews up money, and just as importantly, time.
Mm-hmm.
If you stay east of that line, you can drive from large city to large city, 90 miles, 50 miles, 150 miles. You can hit two or three cities or five cities in a day. You can do, stop in and see people at a bookstore or a ketchup, salsa factory, Mexican restaurant, whatever it is. You can cover more ground east of that line. And I do
all analysis. All told, there are how many of the top 100 markets in America, how many of them are east of that line?
Well, 83.
So 83 versus 17.
Right. And now, of course, L.A. is a huge market. But if you're starting, if you're trying to break something new and develop it, you don't want to be in L.A. or New York anyway. You'd be shredded for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have a good product, other products will have more leverage in the marketplace. You'd just be elbowed out of that market. You need to establish in other markets before you even try to get into those larger markets. Whatever the product is, I'm not talking about music now. And so you go to all the other places, and it's just like if you're a country and western band, you don't go to Nashville. You go everywhere but Nashville. You go to Ireland. If you're an Irish band, you don't go to Dublin, you go to Nashville. You'll be the only Irish band in Nashville. It'll be huge, and you can build on that success. That's big fish, small pond, which that applies to anything. And you start to look at things. We did an analysis of traveling from Chicago to L.A. and back through a few markets versus staying closer to Chicago and just playing the largest markets you could find, the closest to home. There's a $900 difference in gasoline over 14 days. You end up, you can only do 11 shows if you head west. You can do 14 shows. You can play every night if you stay closer to home. You spend 120 hours in your vehicle when you head west. You spend 40 hours in your vehicle if you head east. You just stolen back 80 hours and $800. And for a band, that's the tour support that the record label that doesn't exist won't give you. For anybody else, that's money you don't need to pull from the equity of your home or beg your bank manager for. You could do more. And just a little bit of basic common sense before you head out on one of these crazy expeditions can make it less crazy. I mean, all of these things are crazy. When you're launching a new product or launching a new band, any kind of an idea always seems crazy. People used to think a guy who stayed up every night, didn't change his clothes very often, worked all night for weeks on end was crazy. But not many people think Mr. Kodak is crazy now. You can have crazy entrepreneurial ideas. It doesn't have to be layered with crazy icing on top of the cake, You want the only crazy thing to be your idea and your belief in it, not the mileage. And I think sometimes people get confused with that as well. They're on a crusade, so they want to set themselves these insane, 16-hour drives to the next appointment, so that you're really on a crusade and it becomes an endurance test. And, you don't need an 800-mile drive to make any kind of an entrepreneurial activity an endurance test. It's all an endurance test.
Right. The endurance test will be provided. Extra charge, you know?
Yeah.
And then the last little thing I want to cover, next time I interview you, because I'm sure I'll get another chance for another audience, is lest anybody think that, because we're all consumers of rock and roll, so our idea of rock and roll is we go to the concert, and it's just this big festive, carefree environment, and everybody's having a great time. And so sometimes it may be hard to realize the enormous amount of logistical expertise involved in mounting a tour and keeping it on track and make sure the light man shows up and make sure the right sound equipment is there and keeping the band fed and keeping them out of jail and making sure this happens and that happens. In every business, there's always logistical considerations, and sometimes they can just be, they just seem like the most depressive part of being in a business. And I just want to point out to everybody that's heard this call, if you've only experienced putting on a show from the audience perspective, you're missing one of the most complex logistic feats in business. Because remember, almost every other business, you can, you're working, first of all, behind closed doors, so mistakes are repaired before the product leaves the factory, or the factory can be shut down temporarily, or there's all kinds of wiggle room. When it's if the band is supposed to be on stage at 8 o'clock, if everything, and that the lights and the sound check and the instruments and the band themselves and the security and God knows however many other things I haven't considered. If that all isn't happening perfectly on time, it is a epic disaster. And to run to tour, you have to pull this off night after night after night while living out of a bus.
Right.
So I want to throw that out as sort of a reminder of the credentials of the person that we had the nice opportunity to speak with today.
I think that, I mean, really, and when you do pull it off, because you did 20,000 promotional CDs 8 weeks before the tour started, which you actually made a profit doing because you involved some endorsers and negotiated the contract and got the things you needed from them so they didn't delay the promotional CDs, and then the band all flies in and you get work permits and you rehearse and you make the scenery and somebody's girlfriend leaves them and whatever, so you replace the guitarist and the equipment explodes and whatever. Through all of that, the wonderful thing about the music business is, you can triumph, and then there you are in the office at 2 in the morning, and the promoter decides he's not going to pay you. I've been threatened with guns a few times, and, everything goes well, you get paid, and we had an outbreak of spinal meningitis on one of our tour buses. And as crazy as that is, I know a band whose lead singer died on a bus in the middle of the tour. And you layer that with the basic insecurities of an artistic temperament, the problems of any kinds of substances from alcohol onwards available in large amounts, and you have a recipe for catastrophe. But having done that, having had 3 buses go to 45 cities, several times, anything else just seems like a picnic, I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to do educationally, is use the music business now as this kind of boot camp, training camp, obstacle course for body and brain and heart to train some new entrepreneurs to not get involved in the music business necessarily, but maybe just to shred in the political arena, in the marketing arena, in the worldwide entrepreneurial arena. Mm-hmm. Just the music business is such a crazy place to be. I mean, if you can survive a couple of weeks at the pointy end of it, I mean, honestly, you could do anything. It's great training.
I maybe we'll end on that note, because I will affirm and confirm that I am so grateful that when I was 18, well, actually, it started when I was 15. When I was 15 years old, I've told this story before, but it bears repeating, I went to an all-boys Catholic school, and when we put on our dances, none of the girls from the other schools came. And that was just intolerable to me. So I sat down and I learned marketing right then and there, and I discovered that there were lots of all-girls schools in the city, and that all we had to do was make posters and make sure the posters were made, and then make sure the posters were delivered and make sure the posters were posted. And if we did that consistently, the girls did come. And that led me to producing concerts, and I went through just a mild little taste of what Martin's experienced. But, you know, the whole thing of having to get the band and the lights and the sound and the audience and the security and the money and the, I mean, just it's all got to click. And I'm going to tell you, everybody, that was the absolute best business training I could have ever had in my life. It's the foundation of everything I do. I am so grateful that I had an interest in that when I was young and that I poured myself into it. And for those of you that aren't going to have that experience, Martin is like the living embodiment of what that's like, and I can't wait till Martin, you're in Chicago, and just infusing people with the mindset that's required to win in any circumstance in any field. So, Martin Atkins, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we're looking forward to seeing you in Chicago. If people want to read a really interesting book, whether you're in the music industry or not, whether you ever intend to do a tour or not, I do recommend it highly, Tour Smart and Break the Band. Martin Atkins. It's a big book, heavy. It's a lot of pages.
Nearly 600 pages.
Yeah, and you'll read it and you'll extract so many lessons for your business, whatever your business is, that it'll be well worth having on your shelf. So, Martin, we'll see you in Chicago.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ken. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye.